in what was then the Ottoman Empire. 3 of the 80 seats in Jordan's parliament are reserved for Chechens and Circassians. The Chechens, like the Circassians, are famous for their distinctive wedding rituals. I was fascinated by romantic tales of bridal kidnappings from the homes of disapproving parents. I longed to witness one of these dramatic elopements, when the suitor would gallop up to his beloved and sweep her away to the sound of celebratory gunfire. The Bedouin are the country's traditional desert dwellers. The Bedouin's ancestors, inhabitants of the Arabian Peninsula, were mentioned in the Old Testament's book of Genesis as the children of Shem, son of Noah. Over the centuries, the Bedouin roamed their grazing territories and were known to offer safe transit and use of their wells to Christian pilgrims on their way to the Holy Land. More recently, the Bedouin way of life has changed, and a majority of them have moved to cities like Amman, entering business and serving in the army and government. A dwindling few continue in their traditional lifestyle, moving with the seasons to graze their livestock in the stark beauty of the desert. I admired the Bedouin spirit, envied their freedom, and thought modern man could learn valuable lessons from their total independence from material culture. Though more than 90% of Jordanians are Sunni Muslim, there is also quite a sizable Christian community in Jordan, as evidenced by the 50,000 people who crowded into Amman's sports stadium in 2000 to welcome the Pope. Many are Greek Orthodox, as were my Halabi relatives, and many are descendants of the first Christians in the Holy Land thousands of years ago. Kerak, with its massive Crusader castle, has an ancient population of Christians, as do Sult and Madaba. The most famous mosaic in the region was uncovered in the Greek Orthodox Church of St. George in Madaba. A detailed 6th-century map of the villages, rivers, and valleys of the whole Holy Land, from Egypt to Syria, with the holy city of Jerusalem at the center. Since 1948, Palestinians, who trace their ancestry to the ancient Canaanite Arabs, the earliest known inhabitants of Palestine, have comprised a significant proportion of Jordan's population. According to conservative estimates, some 800,000 Palestinians were forcibly uprooted by the creation of the State of Israel in 1948 and dispersed to Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon. Today, their diaspora includes many countries throughout the world. Over the years, roughly 1.5 million Palestinian refugees have sought safe haven in the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, where they acquired citizenship after the unification of the West Bank and the East Bank of Jordan in 1950. The welcome was warm. In fact, King Hussein was the only head of an Arab state to grant these suddenly stateless people citizenship. The forced migration of Palestinians flooding into Jordan after the 1948 war, and again after the 1967 Arab-Israeli war, almost doubled the population. The strain on Jordan's resources was unmistakable. Where once Amman was comfortably settled on 7 hills, I could now count more than 14. In the space of 30 years, the open hillsides around the citadel and the Roman amphitheater in downtown Amman had become stacked from top to bottom with ramshackle houses, one built over another, until there was not a square meter of open space. Some 80,000 less fortunate refugees were living in 13 crowded refugee camps in Jordan. The refugee crisis reached such magnitude following the 1948 war that the United Nations created a temporary agency, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, UNRWA, to oversee, shelter, and educate more than 3.9 million registered exiled Palestinian refugees in Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, the Gaza Strip, and the West Bank. UNRWA is still struggling to cope with the refugee tragedy today, more than 50 years later. Passing by some of these camps as I traveled around the country, I was amazed by how resourceful those families had to be to survive for so long in conditions everyone had assumed would be short-lived. It was not until I started working and living in Jordan that I began to understand the enormity of this human tragedy. Second and even third generations of Palestinians were being born in the refugee camps in 1977, with nothing to cling to but memories. Many still lived in tents, unwilling to move into more permanent housing, for fear of losing their refugee status, and, with it, their longed-for right to return to their homeland. Some had tattered documents they had fled with 30 years earlier, proving ownership of the land and houses they had been forced from, and more than a few still wore their house keys around their necks. I was fascinated by accounts of the events leading up to the founding of the modern state of Jordan, beginning in 1914 in the holy city of Mecca, in the Hejaz, where Islam was born. Direct descendants of the Prophet Muhammad, the Hashemites had ruled Mecca for more than 1,000 years, and were the hereditary custodians of Islam's most holy places. Mecca, where Muslims believe Abraham rebuilt the first house of worship devoted to God, and where the Prophet was born, and Medina, where in A.D. 662 the Prophet was forced to flee persecution for his beliefs. At the turn of the last century, the Grand Sharif of Mecca, Sharif and Sharifa are titles carried by men and women who are direct descendants of the Prophet Muhammad through the male line. The Hashemite Hussein bin Ali and other prominent Arabs in the region deeply resented the increasingly oppressive policies of the Ottoman Empire, which forbade both the teaching of the Arabic language in schools and its official use. Arab nationalists were being arrested, and the tolerance that had for so long characterized the culture was replaced with persecution. In this political climate, secret societies of Arabs throughout the region turned to Sharif Hussein for leadership. World War I presented the Hashemites with an opening. Sharif Hussein saw the war against the Germans and their allies as an opportunity not only to rid Arab land of the Ottomans after 400 years of occupation, but, after the war, to create an independent confederation of Arab states out of all the Arab provinces of the Ottoman Empire, from Yemen to Syria, including the Arabian Peninsula, Lebanon, Mesopotamia, modern Iraq, and Palestine. The British, after long negotiations in Cairo with Sharif Hussein's son, Abdullah, were receptive. "If you and His Highness your father still favor a movement such as would lead to the full independence of the Arabs," wrote Ronald Storrs, the British Oriental Secretary, "Great Britain is prepared to assist such a movement by all the means in her power." With that and other British statements of support for Arab independence from Sir Henry McMahon, the British High Commissioner in Egypt, Sharif Hussein aligned the Hashemites with the English and mobilized a force of 30,000 Arab tribesmen under the command of three of his sons, Ali, Abdullah, and Faisal. In June 1916, the Great Arab Revolt, as it became known, was launched under the leadership of Sharif Hussein, and it helped change the course of World War I in the Middle East. Over the next 2 years, the Arabs of the Hejaz, under the Hashemite banner, liberated Mecca, Taif, Jeddah, and other Ottoman strongholds. The Arabs repeatedly sabotaged the garrisoned Hejaz railroad, the 820-mile link between Damascus and Medina the Ottomans had built in the early 1900s, denuding many of Jordan's forests in the process. One entire section of track was knocked out of operation by Arab fighters, with the help of the British engineer and military strategist, Captain T.E. Lawrence. In the most daring military move of the campaign, the Hejazis, led by Faisal and Lawrence, traveled 800 excruciating miles from Mecca to liberate Aqaba, with the help of local tribes. The Arabs swept down on the unsuspecting Ottoman armies from the desert the Ottomans had presumed so impassable that their heavy artillery was fixed out to sea. Though Lawrence's camel tripped during the furious raid, and Aqaba was taken before he regained his senses, the legend of Lawrence reached epic proportions in the West, documented first by American journalist Lowell Thomas, then in every retelling of the Great Arab Revolt, including Lawrence's book Seven Pillars of Wisdom and the film Lawrence of Arabia. I remember seeing the film when it first came out in 1962 and marveling at what appeared to be the one-man defeat of the Turks by the eccentric Lawrence. The Arab forces he advised, actually the armies of Hussein's sons, Faisal, Ali, and Abdullah, were depicted as ill-trained, undisciplined, and incapable of defeating the Turks on their own. The film had struck a deep chord in me as an adolescent, at a time when I had just become conscious of my Arab roots and had few references for learning about the history and culture of my heritage. The glorification of Lawrence in the West incensed many Arabs, I later learned, who felt their own leaders were unfairly robbed of rightful credit for a great victory. And they also found a racist subtext in the West's version of the events. The message seemed to be that it took a white man, an Englishman, to make the Arab dream of independence come true. Having liberated Aqaba and the Hejaz, the Arab army drove north until it captured Amman. The great Arab revolt culminated in a victorious march with their European allies into Damascus on October 1, 1918, leading to the Allies' armistice with Turkey 30 days later. What was an undeniable Hashemite triumph in war, however, would not survive the peace. Sharif Hussein, who was proclaimed King of the Hejaz, naturally expected the British to carry out their pledge of support for Arab independence. So did the other Arabs. 3 months after the Hashemite forces rode into Damascus, the Arab-Syrian Congress proclaimed Sharif Faisal king of an independent Syria, while a group of Iraqi leaders chose Sharif Abdullah to be king of newly created Iraq, ancient Mesopotamia. But the Hashemites had been betrayed. In 1916, while they were launching their rebellion against the Ottoman Empire, Britain was already secretly negotiating with France to divide, after the war, the Arab lands whose independence the Hashemites were fighting for. In what became known as the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the French carved out Syria and Lebanon for themselves, and the British took Palestine, Iraq, and the region east of the Jordan River, known as Transjordan. While the British supported Sharif Faisal as the Hashemite king of Syria, the French refused to recognize his government, and in 1920, after 21 months of his rule, drove him forcibly from the throne and into exile. At a 1921 conference in Cairo, presided over by Winston Churchill, then England's colonial secretary, Faisal became the king of Iraq, while Sharif Abdullah became the leader of Transjordan. Churchill rejected Abdullah's entreaties to merge Palestine and Transjordan into one country. Sharif Hussein had committed his sons and his volunteer forces to overthrowing the Turks on the understanding with Britain that all the Arab nations under Turkish occupation, including Palestine, would form a united state after the war. Sir Arthur James Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, had other ideas. Instead of supporting self-determination for the Arabs, who constituted nearly all of Palestine's population and had lived there for centuries, in some cases millennia, he promised their land to the Jewish people as a national home. The Balfour Declaration, the 1917 document that made these fateful moves policy, also stated clearly that nothing shall be done that may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. I was familiar, of course, with the story of the creation of Israel and its turbulent history before I came to Jordan, I was very sympathetic, and still am, to the persecution of the Jewish people through the ages, and sickened by the atrocities committed by Nazi Germany against the Jews during World War II. Everyone I knew, including my new friends in Jordan, expressed horror at the realities of the Holocaust. But they resented, as I was growing to, how Arabs were cast as the aggressors in the dispute between Israel and the Arab countries, when it was their land that had been seized to resolve a European political problem. Jews, Muslims, and Christians had lived peacefully in the Middle East, and indeed in Palestine, for centuries. It was not until the rise of Zionism and the creation of Israel that animosities took root. Theodor Herzl, the father of modern Zionism, was a Hungarian-born Jewish journalist who posited that Jews, however patriotic or good citizens, would never be integrated into the life of any European country because of abiding antisemitism, and were in fact a nation without a land. His solution to this dilemma? The creation of a Jewish nation. Herzl did not insist on Palestine being the only territory for a Jewish nation. He suggested Argentina as well. The British would later offer the Zionists Uganda as a possible homeland, but the offer was rejected. While Herzl and like-minded nationalists might have settled for any territorial solution, the more religious Jews in the Zionist ranks wanted only the Holy Land, Palestine, and what is now Jordan. It would take 50 bloody years to proclaim the State of Israel, the process begun by the Balfour Declaration, which King Hussein called the root cause of almost all the bitterness and frustration in our Arab world today, took a giant step in 1920 when the newly formed League of Nations confirmed Britain's post-war trusteeship of Palestine. The British Mandate, as it was universally called, would last until 1948, and was doomed from the beginning. Promising independence to the Arabs in the wave of post-war Arab nationalism, while at the same time promising a homeland to the Jews, the British Mandate made for an impossible situation. The Arabs feared, and it turned out rightly, that some of the Zionist Jews beginning to arrive in Palestine had no intention of sharing the land, but wanted to own it all. In 1901, the well-funded World Zionist Organization, set up in Basel, established the Jewish National Fund, which immediately began buying up large tracts of Arab land in Palestine, mostly from absentee landlords in Syria and Lebanon. I would meet Palestinians in Jordan who had farmed for many years in Palestine, only to be evicted from their land and their homes. And so the pattern of Palestinian displacement began. Between 1919 and 1921, the acquisition of more and more land, combined with the arrival in Palestine of 18,000 Jewish immigrants, set off riots in Jerusalem and Jaffa. Another 10,000 arrived from Europe in 1928, triggering more riots. The steady influx of Jewish immigrants became a flood after the Nazis took over Germany in 1933. Jewish immigration jumped to 30,000 in 1933, 42,000 in 1934, and 61,000 in 1935. Setting off an Arab revolt that would last for 3 years, before it was brutally suppressed by the British. The pain of the Palestinians did not escape world leaders. Palestine belongs to the Arabs in the same sense that England belongs to the English or France to the French, Mahatma Gandhi said. What is going on in Palestine today cannot be justified by any moral code of conduct. But there was to be no break in the conflict. Fighting resumed again, following the end of World War II, as thousands of illegal refugees came to Palestine. In 1947, the British turned the fate of the region over to the United Nations. On November 29, the UN General Assembly, at the recommendation of Britain, voted to partition Palestine into two states, one Arab, one Jewish, with Jerusalem to be placed under international control. The Arab and non-Arab Muslim member countries, which had countered with a proposal to keep Palestine united as one, voted adamantly against partition. UN Resolution 181 awarded the Jews 55% of the land, though they represented only one-third of Palestine's population and owned only 6% of the land. The Arab countries refused to honor the UN resolution, which passed by only 2 votes, and walked out of the General Assembly in fury. Once again, the future of an Arab people was being decided by European and Western countries. Palestine erupted into a deadly civil war. Many conflicts have an emblematic atrocity that comes to symbolize the war's horror. In Vietnam, it was the massacre of civilians by U.S. soldiers at My Lai. In India, it was the 1919 slaughter of 400 civilians by British troops at Jallianwala Bagh in Amritsar. In Palestine, it was Deir Yassin. I had never heard of Deir Yassin until I came to Jordan. I knew that the Arabs called the tragic events of 1948 Am el-Nakba, which translates as the Year of the Catastrophe. But I did not know any of the details until I started studying the history of Palestine. I soon discovered that there was not a single Palestinian I met who did not know all about Deir Yassin and the massacre of its inhabitants in April 1948 by the Stern Gang, a Jewish terrorist group of several hundred members founded in 1940, and the Irgun, the military arm of the Revisionist Party, under the command of Menachem Begin, a future Prime Minister of Israel. Though the leaders of Deir Yassin had made a peace pact with neighboring Jewish villages, Israeli terrorist forces entered the village on the morning of April 9, 1948, and, after overcoming initial resistance, went house to house, shooting the people inside at close range, then blowing up some of the houses. No one knows the exact number of Palestinians who died that day. The gangs said they killed hundreds. Over the next few days, members of the International Red Cross found bodies dumped in 4 cisterns, stacked in a pit, and buried in the rubble of houses. Most were old men, women, and children. News of the massacre at Deir Yassin rippled through Palestine and had the desired effect of intimidating the population. Palestinian families began to flee their homes all over the country and to seek temporary refuge in neighboring countries. The plan of the radical Zionists to drive out the Palestinians was working. Were it not for the testimony of eyewitnesses, the report of a member of the International Red Cross, and a few brave Jewish scholars who pressed for access to primary sources in Israeli archives, the scope of the tragedy might never have been known. Some key documents are still classified by the Israeli government, including photographs of the aftermath of the attack. Some Zionists even go so far as to deny the massacre ever happened. One bloodbath, of course, led to another. A few days after the massacre at Deir Yassin, Arabs retaliated by ambushing a convoy of Jewish medical personnel. Other atrocities were committed by both sides in the countdown to the withdrawal of the British and the declaration of the State of Israel in May 1948. It was clear that David Ben-Gurion and other Zionist leaders had no intention of allowing the Palestinians to be part of the Jewish state. Jewish military forces had been steadily and systematically depopulating Arab villages for months, driving out the inhabitants and then bulldozing their houses to the ground. Almost all the Palestinian communities between Haifa and Jaffa on the coast had been cleared. Palestinian villages had been captured along the road between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. The Palestinian populations of Haifa and Tiberias had fled, and Arab West Jerusalem had been occupied and the Palestinians driven out. When I was growing up in the United States, the prevailing view of the 1948 Arab-Israeli War was that Israel was forced to defend itself against hordes of bloodthirsty Arabs pouring across its borders. But now that I was living in Jordan, I was discovering that the Arab view was quite the opposite. Israel had been on the offensive, demonstrated by the fact that most of the fighting was not within the territory partitioned to Israel, but in the territory partitioned to the Palestinians. The Arab armies, which were hardly armies save for Jordan's Arab Legion, crossed into Palestine to come to the aid of their Palestinian Arab brethren and to try to prevent Israeli forces from taking more territory. They failed. By the end of the year of the catastrophe, Israel had captured 78% of the land assigned to the Arab state, thereby gaining nearly one-third more of the territory than the UN had originally granted in UN General Assembly Resolution 181, which partitioned Palestine. Israel also ignored UN Resolution 194, passed in December 1948 and reaffirmed many times since, acknowledging the rights of the Palestinians to receive compensation for properties seized and the right of return to their homes. Instead, the Israelis, who by then had depopulated some 500 Arab villages and settlements, leveled the majority of villages and repopulated them with Jewish immigrants. Homeless Palestinians lived in caves and makeshift tents during the cold winter months of 1949, some just miles from their former homes and orchards in the new state of Israel. I remember my mother telling me later that she cried when she saw their suffering during a visit she took to the region with my father. The tiny Hashemite kingdom of Jordan survived the upheaval, but would suffer greatly from the demographic, economic, and political turmoil that came in its wake. This tragic history suffused every aspect of King Hussein's life. For him, matters of state were also matters of the heart. But there were times when he would put aside these pressing issues and relax, and his seaside home in Aqaba was where he was most able to unwind. One week after our first lunch at Hashimiya, the king invited me to Aqaba for the weekend with his children and a group of friends. I was struck at once by how informal he could be. Were it not for the fact that King Hussein was addressed by all, including family, as Sidi, meaning sir, informally, Sayyidna, my lord, more formally, or Jalalat al-Malik, your majesty, and that everyone stood out of respect when he came into a room, it would have been easy to forget that he was, in fact, one of the world's longest-serving and most respected monarchs. He took obvious pleasure in creating a festive, relaxing atmosphere among his guests. He took us all out on his motorboat and tried to persuade us to go water-skiing, even though it was April and the water was still chilly. There was a float in the water just off the beach, and he spent quite a lot of time enticing his children to dog-paddle their way out to it, a surreptitious way of teaching them to swim. We watched movies every night after dinner in the little theater he had had built in the compound. We spent 4 idyllic days in Aqaba. The sunsets were particularly lovely, turning the turquoise sea pink and the mountains along the coastline lavender. Even the tankers anchored offshore had a certain charm, especially at night when they were limned in lights. It was the peak of the oil boom, and the port of Aqaba was full. Added to Aqaba's beauty was its historical significance. Long valued for its coastal location on trade and pilgrimage routes, and its abundance of fresh water just below ground level, Aqaba had been conquered and reconquered since the 10th century BC. From the beach you could see how close were friend and foe. Saudi Arabia was to the southeast, and Egypt to the southwest. Between Egypt and the royal property at Aqaba was Israel and its resort town of Eilat, just a few miles away down the coast to the west. The barbed wire border with Israel was barely half a mile along the beach from the stone jetty on King Hussein's property. One of the more incongruous sights was to see Jordanian soldiers in full gear patrolling one side of the border, and Israeli soldiers the other, with sunbathers on the beaches in the background. I would later become accustomed to the thuds of Israeli depth charges just offshore to discourage enemy frogmen from slipping ashore at night. The Israelis unfortunately destroyed the coral reef off Eilat in the process, killing the habitat for the wide variety of tropical fish in the Gulf. Thankfully, Aqaba's coral reefs remain essentially intact, and a favorite international destination for scuba divers and tourists in glass-bottom boats. I was so engrossed in discovering Aqaba that I was unaware of the personal tensions that were unfolding over the weekend in the royal entourage. Among the house guests was an English photographer, a woman who had been living and working in Jordan for a period of time. She had met the king through friends in England. Someone in the king's entourage told me that she was not happy I was there, a sentiment that I found puzzling, oblivious as I was to the fierce competition for the king's attention. The tiny Hashemite kingdom of Jordan survived the upheaval, but would suffer greatly from the demographic, economic, and political turmoil that came in its wake. This tragic history suffused every aspect of King Hussein's life. For him, matters of state were also matters of the heart. But there were times when he would put aside these pressing issues and relax, and his seaside home in Aqaba was where he was most able to unwind. One week after our first lunch at Hashimiyah, the king invited me to Aqaba for the weekend with his children and a group of friends. I was struck at once by how informal he could be. Were it not for the fact that King Hussein was addressed by all, including family, as Sidi, meaning sir, informally, Sayyidna, my lord, more formally, or Jalalat al-Malik, your majesty, and that everyone stood out of respect when he came into a room, it would have been easy to forget that he was, in fact, one of the world's longest-serving and most respected monarchs. He took obvious pleasure in creating a festive, relaxing atmosphere among his guests. He took us all out on his motorboat and tried to persuade us to go water-skiing, even though it was April and the water was still chilly. There was a float in the water just off the beach, and he spent quite a lot of time enticing his children to dog-paddle their way out to it, a surreptitious way of teaching them to swim. We watched movies every night after dinner in the little theater he had had built in the compound. We spent 4 idyllic days in Aqaba. The sunsets were particularly lovely, turning the turquoise sea pink and the mountains along the coastline lavender. Even the tankers anchored offshore had a certain charm, especially at night when they were limned in lights. It was the peak of the oil boom, and the port of Aqaba was full. Added to Aqaba's beauty was its historical significance. Long valued for its coastal location on trade and pilgrimage routes, and its abundance of fresh water just below ground level, Aqaba had been conquered and reconquered since the 10th century BC. From the beach you could see how close were friend and foe. Saudi Arabia was to the southeast, and Egypt to the southwest. Between Egypt and the royal property at Aqaba was Israel and its resort town of Eilat, just a few miles away down the coast to the west. The barbed wire border with Israel was barely half a mile along the beach from the stone jetty on King Hussein's property. One of the more incongruous sights was to see Jordanian soldiers in full gear patrolling one side of the border, and Israeli soldiers the other, with sunbathers on the beaches in the background. I would later become accustomed to the thuds of Israeli depth charges just offshore to discourage enemy frogmen from slipping ashore at night. The Israelis unfortunately destroyed the coral reef off Eilat in the process, killing the habitat for the wide variety of tropical fish in the Gulf. Thankfully, Aqaba's coral reefs remain essentially intact, and a favorite international destination for scuba divers and tourists in glass-bottom boats. I was so engrossed in discovering Aqaba that I was unaware of the personal tensions that were unfolding over the weekend in the royal entourage. Among the house guests was an English photographer, a woman who had been living and working in Jordan for a period of time. She had met the king through friends in England. Someone in the king's entourage told me that she was not happy I was there, a sentiment that I found puzzling, oblivious as I was to the fierce competition for the king's attention. We returned to Amman on April 16, and the king began inviting me to Hashimiya for dinner. Although his life there was decidedly more constrained than in Aqaba, over meals we had enough privacy to talk at length about a wide range of subjects, including our childhoods. We found that we had led oddly parallel lives. Oldest children, we were both shy and had few trusted friends. We had both been sent to a bewildering succession of schools, Hussein to 7 and I to 5. We had both emerged from our family experiences and disjointed schooling with a determination to be self-reliant. We also discovered that we had both had difficult relationships with our fathers and special relationships with a grandparent, he with his grandfather, King Abdullah, and I with my paternal grandmother. His bond with his grandfather, however, was profoundly significant and had been cruelly broken under dramatic circumstances. In 1951, young Prince Hussein had been in Jerusalem, standing 10 feet away from King Abdullah, when his grandfather was assassinated by a Palestinian for his efforts to explore a political solution with Israel. Hussein was 16 at the time, and many years later still found it hard to talk about that shocking moment at the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where King Abdullah had taken him for Friday prayers. A gunman had suddenly stepped out from behind a pillar and shot the king point-blank in the head. Hussein could still see his grandfather's white turban roll to a stop in front of his feet, see his grandfather's entourage flee for their own safety, see the gunman turn, aim his pistol at the young prince's chest, and fire. Only the medal on the military uniform, a decoration that his grandfather had insisted he wear that morning, saved his life by deflecting the bullet. Hussein became crown prince, and his father, Talal, became king. But for only 12 months. King Talal was a victim of schizophrenia, characterized by erratic and mercurial behavior. Hussein had great regard for his father's intelligence and sensitivity, but as much as he loved him, he feared for him and despaired over his deepening decline into mental illness. The king always seemed so sad when he spoke about his father, whom he had loved deeply. He admired the courage it had taken for King Talal to try to reign as king, and the enormous contribution he had made to the country when he ushered in a democratic constitution that was revolutionary for its time and remains the country's legal blueprint to this day. But his health could not withstand the pressure. On August 11, 1952, after being examined by 3 Jordanian doctors and 2 foreign specialists, King Talal was removed from the throne by a vote in Parliament. Crown Prince Hussein was in Switzerland on holiday from the Harrow School outside London when he abruptly heard the news. There was a knock on the door, and the hotel page delivered a cablegram from the royal court in Jordan, addressed to His Majesty King Hussein, he remembered. He was just shy of his 17th birthday. He finished at Harrow, and undertook a condensed course to receive his commission from the Royal Military Academy, Sandhurst. By the age of 18, Hussein was Jordan's full-time ruler. Hussein's life had been amazing. I could not help being impressed by his intelligence and valor. I was drawn, too, to his vitality and huge store of energy. But there were quiet moments alone in my flat when I worried where it was all going. It was a delight, a privilege, really, to spend time with him. But we had begun spending a great deal of time together, and I was starting to wonder whether our idol would become more complicated. What if he made an overture for a more intimate relationship? How would I deal with that? Gossip had it that the king was a playboy, and I did not want this precious friendship to lead to a stereotypical royal affair. I could not imagine myself in such a situation, and hoped that our uncomplicated friendship would go on forever. My father was somewhat uneasy as well. When he passed briefly through Amman en route to the United States, he cautioned me to be careful. I will never forget him standing by my car in the Intercontinental Hotel parking lot, saying, "Take care, Lisa. The royal court is full of intrigues, and this society can be vicious. I like King Hussein very much, as you know, but I don't want you to be hurt." I was surprised by his words, and gave him a searching look, thinking that his concern was misplaced. "You know, there's nothing for you to worry about," I said. "This is not like other courts. There are no intrigues here." I would look back on that conversation in later years with wry amusement. For the moment, I was enjoying the king's company, and evidently he was enjoying mine. The day after my father left, my diary entry reads, "Surprise visit." Then, his words to me when he stopped by unexpectedly, "I miss you." I realize now that he was sending obvious signals that had been going over my head. At the time, I did not question the evenings we spent with his three youngest children, reading to them, hearing their prayers at night, and putting them to bed. We dined and watched the original bulky NTSC video films every night in his spacious sitting room. Hussein had the first video machine I had ever seen, and he also screened films playing in the local cinemas. His favorites were John Wayne films, The Quiet Man in particular, Peter Sellers's The Party, and heroic films like Charlie Chaplin's Limelight, because, he explained, one man survives against all the bad guys. One film, The Day of the Dolphin, became a source of great amusement between us. George C. Scott plays a scientist training a pair of dolphins and manages to get them to speak and understand English, albeit with a very limited vocabulary. Hussein would make me laugh by mimicking the dolphin voice in the film, "Fa loves be," with its playful suggestion of our own budding affections. Perhaps our most private moments were long motorcycle rides throughout Amman and the surrounding countryside. One lovely spring evening, the king adroitly managed to lose his security detail on Amman's narrow streets, and we spent an evening alone touring the city. I felt an exhilarating sense of freedom, however briefly. What fun it was to savor the life of ordinary people out on the town! One day, we flew out to the Dead Sea to scout out an area that might make a good tourist resort, with Hussein at the controls of his favorite helicopter, an Alouette. Its bubble-shaped cockpit provides such extraordinary visibility that I felt as though I were flying unencumbered through the air. I sat in the front passenger seat next to King Hussein as we floated above the Amman Plateau, then out over the valleys, known as wadis, and waterfalls that plunge down to the desert, then into a field by the Dead Sea, the lowest point on earth. The days and evenings I spent with the king were exciting on both an intellectual and a personal level, but also quite exhausting. I was waking every morning at 6 to go to work, and the evenings I spent with the king always involved a long dinner followed by a film, sometimes more than one. Often I would not return home until 1 or 2 a.m. At best, I was getting 4 or 5 hours of sleep. I was also losing weight. King Hussein ate his meals very rapidly, a habit that he had developed during his days at Sandhurst, and that was reinforced later as a survival strategy in his fast-paced official life. While he ate at supersonic speed, I ate slowly, in part because that was my habit, and in part because we were having such interesting conversations. He would finish an entire meal while I was still trying to finish my soup. I felt it would be impolite to continue eating once he had finished, so very often that would be all I would get. And with most of my free time taken up with our meetings at Hashimiya, I never had a moment to stock my own kitchen. I lost between 10 and 15 pounds, not that I minded, I thought I had learned a great deal from my reading and from meetings with foreign correspondents who had come through the region, but with King Hussein I was receiving a doctorate degree. His greatest sorrow, he told me, was the disastrous 1967 Arab-Israeli War and Israel's subsequent military occupation of Jerusalem and the West Bank. As he recounted the unfolding events of the war, a tale of great deceit and squandered opportunities, he had tears in his eyes. I was fascinated to learn of King Hussein's apprehensive role in the 1967 war, which was not unlike King Abdullah's in the 1948 war. They both knew that the Arab armies were no match for the better-equipped and better-trained Israeli forces. More important, they understood that the only lasting solution would have to be political, not military. The countdown had begun 2 years earlier, in an already very tense Middle East, when Israeli settlers started plowing land in the demilitarized zone between Israel and Syria near the Sea of Galilee. In the view of many, Israel's strategy was to provoke the Syrians into shooting at the settlers, so the Israeli army could justify a disproportionate reprisal. "If they didn't shoot, we would tell the tractor to advance further, until in the end the Syrians would get annoyed and shoot," Moshe Dayan, Israel's defense minister, would be quoted in the New York Times as saying. "And then we would use artillery, and later the Air Force also." The pivotal provocation occurred in April 1967. Soon after the anticipated Syrian response began, Israel went on its planned offensive, inflicting heavy casualties on the ground and shooting down 6 Syrian MiG-21s, some over Damascus. Amid rumors that the Israeli Defense Forces, commanded by Yitzhak Rabin, were massing tanks near the Syrian border, Egypt, which had a defense pact with Syria, called on the United Nations to remove its peacekeeping troops on the Egyptian side of the border with Israel, then replaced them shortly thereafter with Egyptian troops, and closed the Straits of Tiran to Israeli shipping. No one knows to this day whether Egypt's President Gamal Abdel Nasser was bluffing or not. In the countdown to war, Israel assured King Hussein that Israeli forces would not attack Jordan if it remained neutral, despite the fact that in November Israeli troops had overrun the Jordanian West Bank village of Samur, destroying 125 houses, a clinic, and its school, killing and wounding innocent civilians. UN Security Council Resolution 228 censured Israel for the attack. It was an offer King Hussein could not accept. "I was in an impossible situation," he told me more than a decade later. Acting on their own, Palestinian commandos in Jordan were staging raids against Israel, bringing heavy Israeli retaliation against Arab villages on the West Bank. The Palestinian population in Jordan was enraged by the Israeli attacks, and many focused their fury at King Hussein for not protecting them. In weighing the balance of whether or not to go to war with Israel, he was damned if he did and damned if he didn't. The reality was that the Jordanian army was outmanned and outgunned by the Israeli forces, both on the ground and in the air. "I risked military defeat if we fought Israel," he told me. "I risked endangering Jordan's security and stability if we didn't." King Hussein flew to Egypt to see President Nasser and reluctantly joined the military alliance with Egypt and Syria, agreeing that Jordanian troops would fall under Egyptian command. He assembled his army officers, among them 3 members of the royal family. He wanted them to know the truth. "We are being forced into a war with Israel, and though I know you will do your best, we are going to lose," he told them, assessing the dismal balance of power. But the officers, including his first cousin, Prince Ali bin Nayef, refused to accept his conclusion. "As soldiers, we thought we were much better than the Israelis," Prince Ali later recalled. "We were tougher, we were stronger, we were better trained, and we were more courageous. But they had more equipment, ammunition, and petrol for their tanks." There were conflicting views as to how the war actually started, but in all the debate one fact is indisputable. Israel struck the first blow. The war was essentially over before it began, though no one, including King Hussein, knew it. On June 5, 1967, the Israeli Air Force launched a surprise attack, flying under Egyptian radar and destroying virtually every one of Egypt's fighter plane units from Cairo to Alexandria while they were still on the ground. The Israeli planes then proceeded to strafe unprotected Egyptian ground forces in the Sinai, opening the way for Israeli troops to invade Egypt and rout the retreating Egyptians. The looming disaster for Jordan was cemented by an inexplicable radio announcement that morning from the Egyptian commander-in-chief, Field Marshal Abdul Hakim Amer, that it was the Egyptian Air Force that had been victorious. Not only had Egyptian planes shot down 75% of the Israeli Air Force, he postured, but Egyptian ground forces were advancing into Israel. President Nasser, who apparently had not been fully informed, repeated this to King Hussein over the phone some hours later. It would be days, in fact, before the citizens of Jordan and Egypt would know the truth. But the damage had long since been done. 3 hours after the demolition of the Egyptian Air Force, that same Egyptian commander-in-chief in Cairo ordered Jordanian forces into a war that had already been lost. It was a disaster from the beginning. Jordan had only 16 pilots trained to fly its 22 Hunter Hawk fighter planes. They completed one bombing run, but when the planes returned to Jordan to refuel, the Israeli Air Force crossed the border and destroyed them all on the ground. The Israelis then took aim at Amman, one missile finding its mark through the wall at Basman Palace, where King Hussein then resided, and destroying a chair in the king's study. Jordanian ground forces did not fare much better, although they fought bravely. Without any air or ground support from the Egyptians, the Jordanian troops exposed in the desert were being wiped out by the Israeli Air Force. Time and again, King Hussein put himself at risk, traveling to the front and encouraging his troops. He had several narrow escapes, one with his cousin, Prince Raad, on the second day of the war. After meeting with the Prime Minister, King Hussein had insisted on going to visit the Army High Command, which was north of Amman. To get there, he had to pass by the Iraqi army's encampment near Suwayle, which had been bombed by the Israelis the day before, at around the same time, with many casualties. I pleaded with him not to go at that time, arguing that the Israeli Air Force might make another bombing run at the Iraqis, Prince Raad later told me, but he looked at me with a fury I'd never seen before in his eyes. So we went. Prince Raad is convinced that God protected King Hussein. Low clouds suddenly came in along their route and covered them as they passed the dangerous intersection and continued on to Army headquarters. They were having coffee at the headquarters when the clouds parted, and they saw sunlight reflecting off the Israeli planes, bright and sparkling, as once again they bombed the Iraqi positions. The two men returned safely to Amman, where King Hussein resumed his vigil, circulating among his troops, keeping radio contact, meeting with his generals and government. "I didn't sleep for 48 hours," he told me. King Hussein appealed to the UN Security Council for a ceasefire on June 6, just 24 hours into what became known as the Six-Day War. However, arguments over the wording of the ceasefire delayed its adoption for another critical 24 hours. The delay gained the Israelis their objective of seizing as much territory as they could, just as they had in 1948. Even after King Hussein formally accepted the ceasefire proposal on June 7, the ceasefire announcement was broadcast regularly over Radio Amman, Israeli forces continued to fight Jordanians in Jerusalem and to seize control of the West Bank. Israeli forces then set their sights on the Golan Heights, ignoring, as they had with Jordan and Egypt, a UN-sponsored ceasefire with Syria. An American electronic intelligence ship, the USS Liberty, was steaming off the coast of Gaza on June 8, the fourth day of the Six-Day War, listening to and relaying Israeli preparations for the invasion of Syria, when the ship's communication channels were suddenly jammed, and the ship was just as suddenly attacked, first by unmarked Israeli fighter planes, then by torpedo boats. 34 American sailors were killed, another 175 wounded. Israel quickly apologized for the attack, insisting it was an accident, but others disagree. Many, including senior U.S. officials, expressed outrage that Israeli forces could have deliberately attacked the Liberty to halt the flow of intercepted messages and mask Israel's intentions to seize more territory. Hours after Syria accepted the Security Council's ceasefire on the morning of June 9, the Golan Heights fell to Israel's massive air and artillery attack, cementing Israel's goal. In less than a week, Israel had seized enough territory to more than triple its land. The entire area of Palestine, originally allocated to the Palestinians under the British Mandate and the United Nations, was now under Israeli control. The war took a terrible toll on Jordan and its people. 700 soldiers were killed, and more than 6,000 were wounded or missing. One of the missing was Prince Ali, who was presumed dead by King Hussein and the rest of the royal family. Prince Ali's wife, Princess Wijdan, told me of her anguish as she went to the army hospital every day to look for his body. "The dead and wounded were coming in trucks, horribly burned by napalm," she told me. "I volunteered to feed the wounded because they couldn't feed themselves." As each new truckload came in, she would call out, "Anybody in the 3rd Brigade? Anybody in the 3rd Brigade?" Finally, one of the wounded soldiers said yes, and that he had seen Prince Ali 2 days earlier, still sitting on a tank with a machine gun aimed at the Israeli planes overhead. 3 days later, Prince Ali came home. "We were ashamed to come back, having lost the war," Prince Ali told her. "So we just stayed there." King Hussein was crushed. He would always take Jordan's losses very personally. In less than a week, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan had lost half its territory. The Palestinian lands it had assumed responsibility for protecting in 1950, including Jerusalem, Bethlehem, Hebron, Jericho, Nablus, and Ramallah. The entire West Bank and its fertile farmland were occupied by Israel, sending a new wave of some 400,000 Palestinian refugees into Jordan. The country's economy, which was one of the most promising in the Arab world, was in tatters. The flourishing tourist industry completely dried up, foreign investments slowed, and development projects were shelved. "Those 6 days of war," the king told me, "were the worst days of my life." His cousin, Sharif Abdul Hamid Sharaf, told me that the king, in a private moment, had wept bitterly over the loss of Jerusalem, the holy city his grandfather had fought for and saved for Arabs and Muslims. It was the first time he had ever seen the king cry. "I cannot accept that Jerusalem is lost in my time," the king had lamented. From that moment, the king said, he had put all his energies into trying to rebuild what had been lost, and to secure a just and comprehensive peace, not only for the Palestinians, but for the stability of the entire region, and, by extension, the world. His journey had taken him to New York in November 1967, just 5 months after the war, where the United Nations, too, was trying to find a peaceful and equitable resolution to the ongoing Arab-Israeli conflict. King Hussein stayed at the Waldorf Hotel, as did Egypt's foreign minister, Mahmoud Riyad, Israel's foreign minister, Abba Eban, and Arthur Goldberg, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Meeting separately around the clock, in secret, with Goldberg, the men eventually agreed to the wording of what would become UN Resolution 242, when it was unanimously adopted by the Security Council on November 22. Resolution 242 laid out the principles for peace in the Middle East, emphasizing the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, a basic premise of the UN Charter, and calling for the withdrawal of Israeli armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict, in exchange for acknowledgement of the sovereignty, territorial integrity, and political independence of every state in the area, and their right to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries free from threats or acts of force. After being given assurances by U.S. Secretary of State Dean Rusk and President Lyndon Johnson that Israel would return a substantial portion of the West Bank to Jordan within 6 months, King Hussein accepted Resolution 242 and its formula of land for peace. "I was assured by the Americans that Israel was on board," King Hussein said. "They told me that 6 months would be the outside limit for its implementation. I believed them." But just as his great-grandfather had been deceived in 1917, so was King Hussein let down in 1967. As we lingered over dinner at Hashimiya in 1978, Israel still had not withdrawn from the Arab lands it had seized more than a decade earlier. From the terrace of the palace, we could look over and see the lights of historic Jerusalem nearly obscured by the lights of the encircling settlements and developments that the Israelis had built around the holy city. The reminders of the impasse